Right, I'm just going to start now, and I think a few of you will just filter in as we go. So, welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session. We're into episode two of 2025 already. I hope you've all had a good start to the new year. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We work with companies that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. At this point, I would usually welcome my colleague, Adrienne, but you'll know that she is not on screen today. And that is because she has succumbed to the flu that's going around at the moment. So I'm flying solo today, which means you've got to put up with my dulcet tones for the next half an hour or so. So apologies in advance for that. Just a couple of housekeeping points before we get into the meat of today's session. For those of you that are joining live, if you want to ask some questions, I'll do my best to deal with them either during the session or if there's time at the end. Just use the Q&A function that's down in the toolbar at the bottom. If you would like to pass any messages or chat to anybody in the group as a whole, then feel free to use the chat function as well. But if you've got specific questions, and please do ask questions, just use the Q&A function. If you are listening to this on Spotify or Amazon Music and you want to join live, you can go to the MPM Legal website and sign up to be invited to these sessions, which run every 2 weeks on a Thursday at 11 o'clock. Okay, that being said, what are we talking about today? We are looking at 2P and changing terms of employment and the practical aspects of that when it comes to objecting to transfers. And the reason we're looking at that is there was a case in the Employment Appeals Tribunal at the end of 2024. It was reported in December. And the EAT just clarified some principles around the operation of 2P. Now, 2P is one of those areas that we always seem to get asked questions about, not in terms of, hey, how do we approach this particular scenario, but just a kind of thirst for knowledge and information. And some people I know absolutely love 2P, and some people absolutely loathe having to deal with 2P. I used to loathe dealing with it, but as my practice developed and we started doing a lot more 2P work, I've actually grown to like it. I was going to say love it, but I won't put it that strongly, I don't think. But I don't mind 2P at all. I quite enjoy dealing with it. It is a super technical area of the law. So if you're used to dealing with employee relations and, you know, sorting out practical stuff, getting totally immersed in the peculiarities of the 2P regs can be a little bit mind-numbing sometimes because it is very, very technical. But it's good fun. It's good fun. I appreciate those of you that are joining today are probably going to have different experiences and levels of understanding in terms of what 2P actually means. So before we get into the case, let me just give you a high-level intro. 2P stands for the Transfer of Undertakings Protection of Employment Regulations, and it's a set of rules that are derived originally from European level, and it's all about protecting employee rights. And 2P generally applies in two main situations. The first is business acquisition scenarios. So one company purchases another company and then wants to fold all of those employees into its own company. The acquirer folds people in. So that's your kind of classic, we're buying another business, we're inheriting all of these employees. What do we need to do regarding 2P? The other main scenario where it comes up is in relation to what we call service provision changes. And I'll illustrate what that means using cleaning contracts as an example. So, if you're a company and you employ cleaners to clean your offices, you have a direct employment relationship, you may decide, hey, we want to outsource this cleaning function to a third-party contractor who's a cleaning contractor. There's scope for 2P to bite onto that transaction and your cleaning employees to follow the work out to the third-party cleaning company. So there'll be an outsourcing 2P on a service provision change. Now, two other examples in relation to service provision changes related to that example I've given. Number one, at the end of the cleaning contract outsourcing, you decide that the third-party company haven't been that great, and you're actually can do a better job yourself. So you want to bring the services back in-house and directly employ cleaners again. That's an in-housing, and Tupi can apply to you bringing those services back. So you potentially inherit the cleaning employees currently employed by the third-party contractor. The other scenario there is you get to the end of the cleaning contract that you've outsourced. You don't like the third-party cleaning company, and you decide we're going to use this other company over here that we've heard great things about. That's the second generation outsourcing, and Tupi has the potential to bite on those employees who will transfer from the original third-party cleaning contractor to the new company that you engage. Now, there are obvious downsides for businesses in respect of 2P applying, because quite often, especially service provision scenarios, the reason why you might want to change service provider in the first place is because the individuals are not doing a great job. And the big downside is if those individuals form part of the grouping of employees that transfers over, it's going to be the same people probably coming in and doing the job. Now, there are ways around that. I'm not going to go into those in this session today. But that is one obvious downside. But remember, the starting point of these regulations is all about employee rights protection. It's helping out the little guy. It's making sure that their employment T's and C's are protected. Okay. In terms of employee rights and 2P transfers themselves, some of you anticipate may have come across a situation where an individual does not want to transfer over. So they say, hey, I don't like the look of working for that company. I don't want to move. Well, what happens in those scenarios? Bear in mind, 2P applies automatically. So it's an automatic operation of law. So parties can't elect for 2P to apply. It's not a situation where you can say, okay, 2P applies to this scenario, but we're going to agree between us that it doesn't apply, because it either applies as a matter of law or it doesn't. And the arbiter of that will be an employment judge if you don't follow the rules and somebody brings a claim. So if 2P bites, the starting point is everybody's contracts and all the rights, powers, duties, and liabilities associated with those contracts transfer over from the outgoing employer, who we're going to call the transferor, to the new incoming employer, who we call the transferee. That being said, employees have the right to object to the transfer to a new employer by telling either the transferor, their current employer, or the transferee, their purported new employer, that they don't wish to transfer. So they object to the transfer. Now, if the employee objects, the contract of employment doesn't transfer over. And instead, you kind of have this legal oddity where the employee's employment ends. So there's a termination, but for employment law purposes, they're not treated as having been dismissed. Okay. So employment ends, but it's not a dismissal in law. And the relevance of that is it means they can't bring a claim for unfair dismissal because there hasn't been a dismissal in the first place. And it sounds a bit unusual because obviously their employment has ended, but that's just an oddity of the 2P regulations. So you object to the transfer, your employment ends, but there's not a dismissal in law, so there's no basis on which to bring an employment tribunal claim. But, and as always, there is a but. If the transfer to the new employer involves a substantial change in the employee's working conditions to their material detriment, then the employee may treat their contract as having been terminated. And in those circumstances, whoever is deemed the employer is treated as having dismissed the employee. So there is a dismissal in law. Now, you're going to be a step ahead of me. That obviously means that there is then potential for liability, potential for an individual to bring some type of claim against whoever their employer is deemed to be. And last preliminary point, the employee's right to terminate their employment contract without notice in anticipation of a repudiatory breach of contract is preserved. What we're talking about there in normal terms? Constructive dismissal. So an employee can look at the situation and say, hey, I feel this is a constructive dismissal scenario because there's a material change to my terms and conditions of employment. They're going to be to my material detriment. and I'm allowed to resign and claim that I've been constructively dismissed. And in those circumstances, again, there is a dismissal in law, and that means there is scope for liability. So there's a difference. If you're an employee and you just object to the transfer, and it's not an objection because there's going to be any change to your T's and C's, there's no material detriment to you, then your employment ends, there's no dismissal in law, you can't bring a claim. If, however, you're resigning in circumstances where there is going to be a material change and it is to your detriment, you potentially are then treated as having been dismissed in law, and there is an avenue open to you. Okay. I appreciate today's session is a little bit more technical than usual, by the way. It's not lost on me. Let's talk about the case from before Christmas. So the case that looked at these principles and just gave us a little bit more guidance is the case of London United Busways Limited and DiMarchi. Maybe it's DiMarchi, I don't know. But London United Busways Limited and DiMarchi. So what are the facts of that particular case? Well, Mr. DiMarchi had been a bus driver, and he had been a bus driver since 2003. And all of these events happened in 2019. So he'd got a good stint of service. Now, he worked based out of a bus depot that was 15 minutes walk from his house. And that's significant because he didn't drive, didn't have access to a car, and he used to walk to and from work. Now, in 2019, there was a retendering exercise. Busways lost the contract for operating the route that he drove on, and the work was instead won by a company called Abellio London Limited, so Abellio. So if you remember, that's an example of a service provision change. London were operating the route, they lost the contract, it went to another provider, 2p bytes, and in theory, Mr. DiMarchi's employment transfers over from London to Abellio. But of course, it wasn't as simple as that, and that's why there was litigation. All drivers assigned to that route would be transferring under 2p from Busways to Abellio unless they objected. Now, of significance here is the fact that Abellio said, well, we don't have a garage depot on the same site as London Busways, unsurprisingly. So you've got to work out of a different garage. And unfortunately for Mr. DiMarchi, that garage was an hour away from where he lived. So he had a massively increased commute time because he couldn't walk to work in 15 minutes anymore. So that's the context for this. Busways go to their employees, including Mr. DiMarchi, and they say, right, here are the options you've got. Number one, you can transfer over to Abellio, but that obviously means that you've got to move depot. So you're going to be starting and finishing your shifts somewhere else. But that's option one. Option two, you can object to the transfer because you're allowed to do that. But if you object to the transfer, you've got to sign a new employment contract with us. You'll stay at your current depot, but you have to agree to increase your maximum time on duty. So instead of working a maximum of 9 hours a shift, you're going to have to work 10 hours a shift. That's quite a change. Number three, if you don't like either of those two options, then on your bike, you can resign. You know, you don't have to stay working here. So, you know, three quite clear options there. Mr. DiMarchi didn't like that, understandably. He said, well, is redundancy an option for me? And Busways said, no, it's not. Now, I anticipate the reason they may have said no is they didn't want the cost of redundancy. It had obviously been there for, what, 15 years or so. Who knows whether there were any enhanced entitlements to redundancy pay. But he was pushing for redundancy, and Busways, his employer, saying, no, redundancy is not an option for us. So Mr. DiMarchi gets into this dialogue with his employer, and he's saying, well, there's extra travel time to get to work. My life's going to be disrupted. It's not in my best interest to sign a new contract, but I don't want to resign. Can I just stay on my original contract? That's what I want. And if you don't want me to stay on my original contract, I think that I should be made redundant. Now, there's a lot of back and forth then between them. He goes off sick with the stress of the situation, and things come to a head around the transfer date. His employer wrote to him to say, well, you're not accepting alternative employment with us. You're not resigning. So your employment's going to transfer over automatically to Abellio. Then his employer did a bit of an about face and said, well, actually, we've thought about this some more. Because you objected to the transfer in previous correspondence we've had, we think your employment's going to end on the transfer date because of your objection, and you'll not be treated as having been dismissed. And if you remember what I said at the start about no deemed dismissal, employment just terminates. So there's this dialogue going. And then in the background, there's also communication with Abellio. So Abellio are involved because Mr. Demarty's off sick. He's sending his sick notes into to Busways. Busways are just sending them on to Abellio and saying, look, this guy's your problem now. You've got to deal with it. And Abellio are writing to him to say, hey, welcome on board. You're now our employee. And I mean, to his credit, Mr. DeMarkey is like, I'm not engaging in this. You're not my employer. So I'm not sending you my fit notes. And I'm not holding myself out as having been employed by you. So there's this really unusual situation where Mr. DeMarkey is saying, I'm not employed by Abellio. Abellio get to the point where they say, well, actually, we don't think you should have transferred over to us because you objected. And Busways are saying, hey, it's not our problem. We think that he objected under 2P, and he's no longer our employee. All of this culminated in the following January when Abellio wrote to Mr. DeMarkey and they said, well, redundancy is not an option. We think that you've automatically transferred over to us. Come to a meeting. And if you don't, then we'll just treat you as being absent without authorization. And of course, he didn't reply because his view was, you're not my employer. So in February, Abellio wrote and said, you didn't come to the meeting, you failed to engage, so we've decided to dismiss you. And he didn't reply to that either. What he did do was bring claims in the Employment Tribunal against Busways and Abellio. Okay. So then we get the tribunal litigation. There was a preliminary hearing, and the tribunal decided that Mr. DeMarchi had been dismissed by Busways, so his employer all along, on the 8th of November, which was a day before the 2P transfer. So they said he didn't transfer over. He objected to the transfer. That prevented his employment from transferring over to the new company. And by attempting to transfer him despite his objection, the London Bus Company had dismissed him. Okay, so that's what the tribunal found. There was a dismissal. Both employer and claimant actually, they both appealed to the ET. So the employer appealed and the claimant did a cross appeal. Now, the EAT dismissed both appeals. It dismissed the appeal and it dismissed the cross appeal. But inevitably, for different reasons than what the tribunal came up with. And this is the interesting part. They've come up with some clarification as to how objections under 2P actually apply. And what they said was the way it works is if an employee objects, then it prevents them from transferring their contract of employment. So as a matter of fact, there's no 2P transfer because of the objection. Then what we need to look at is whether or not the employee is deemed to have been dismissed. So if you go back to those provisions I read out at the start, is it a scenario where the employee objects and they're treated as no dismissal in law, but their employment ends? Or is it a situation where they're entitled to treat their employment as being at an end and that is classed as a dismissal in law and they're then free to bring a claim? And what the EAT helpfully did for us was just summarize the interplay of these rules. So what we now know is where there's a transfer that involves or would involve a substantial change in working conditions, and those change conditions are going to be to the material detriment of the employee, then the individual can treat the contract of employment as having been terminated. And if the employee elects to exercise that right, they'll be treated as having been dismissed by the employer. Now, who is the employer in that situation? Well, if all of this happens pre-transfer, their employer is going to be their original employer. So in Mr. DeMarchi's case, it was a London bus company that were employing him. However, if they don't exercise that right, 2P bites, they transfer over to the new employer, And at that point, they can object to the material changes to their contracts of employment, effectively claim constructive dismissal, and they can then bring a claim against the new employer. So the liability moves over. Bear in mind that if an employee objects to becoming an employee of the transferee, okay, in circumstances where they anticipate a change to contracts and that material detriment, then the effect of that objection prevents their transfer. So they won't transfer over, and any of the rights and obligations don't transfer over to the incoming employer. It all sticks with the outgoing employer. Okay. So just coming back to the circumstances of this case, although the EAT disagreed with how the tribunal at first level actually came up with the decision, they found that the tribunal did make the right decision, which was that his employment contract didn't transfer over on the transfer date. And what happened was the effect of that transfer terminated his employment with Busways because of his objection. And that objection was based on the substantial change in working conditions, which were to his material detriment, you know, the change in location. So he was entitled to be treated as dismissed by Busways, and that's the only entity against which there's any liability. So Abellio kind of got away scot-free in the end. There was no liability laid at that door, albeit they had to go through the rigmarole of defending employment tribunal proceedings. So what that case tells us then is it's not necessary for an employee who objects to the transfer to communicate unequivocally and unambiguously that they're treating their contract as being terminated. Their objection is sufficient to terminate the contract and for them to be treated as dismissed by the transferor, who in turn is liable for the dismissal. Okay. And that's different to a scenario where somebody objects when there's no material detriment to them, there's no change of T's and C's, and then there is no liability against either the old employer or the new employer. So what's the takeaway from this? Well, if you have 2P transfer exercises and you've got employees who are objecting to the 2P transfer, that can result in a dismissal by you if the transfer involves a substantial material detrimental change in working conditions, even though it's not you that are making those changes. It's the new party that are coming in who are making the changes. You will be liable for that dismissal. So, you know, it feels a bit harsh in that respect. And what can you do about that liability? Well, remember, you're going to be getting measures information from the new employer. So if they're doing things properly, they should be writing to you. They should be explaining what steps they're going to be taking post-transfer. And that's your opportunity to engage with your employees and pass on that information and to flush out whether there are likely to be any issues. The other big thing to consider here, though, are the commercial agreements that you have in place. And you ought to have commercial agreements in place that cover these situations, because there are lots of things that you need to consider about how you apportion liabilities, whether you get indemnities, whether you get warranties written into those commercial agreements. But what you probably want to do is make sure that those commercial agreements have adequate protections built into them to try and mitigate the risks if the incoming employer are looking to make changes to T's and C's. Okay. So it's quite a useful case, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. In terms of changes to T's and C's more generally on a 2P transfer, the starting point is that they're generally not permitted. Okay, so the whole idea, I mean, bearing in mind what I said at the start about the fact that the legislation is there to protect employee rights, it would undermine it if employers were allowed to just willy-nilly change people's terms and conditions on a 2P transfer. So think of it as new employer steps into the old employer's shoes. So they just step into the contract, taken all the rights and liabilities, and things should continue as usual. Now, of course, we know that in reality, things don't always work that way. And there will be occasions if you're inheriting employees that you want to make certain changes. Now, whether or not you can make those changes depends on the reasons why you want to make the change. So harmonization of terms and conditions of employment, which I know can be really problematic if you, especially if you're in an industry where there's a lot of outsourcing and in-housing and you're inheriting employees, harmonization per se is not permitted. So any changes through harmonization avoidable, which means, you know, you potentially just can't enforce on them. And if you're trying to change T's and C's, it's open to an employee to go to an employment tribunal and ask for a declaration as to what their employment contract rights actually are, and a tribunal make a decision on that. So harmonization, you shouldn't be doing it. It's very difficult to do. However, there are ways around. And if you're making favorable changes to employees, of course, nobody in reality is going to complain if you're giving somebody a pay rise, or if you're giving them more annual leave, or if you're introducing some wonderful new contractual provision that really benefits them. But, you know, in reality, you're not going to have an issue with your workforce, because why would someone complain about those things? Where we see issues are if you're trying to reduce people's hours of work, when you're trying to relocate, if you're trying to chip away at their pay and benefits. They're the things that cause problems. There are a subset of changes allowed if you are making them for what's called an ETO reason. Now, ETO means economic, technical, or organizational reason that entails changes in the workforce. And changes in the workforce includes if you need to operate at a different location. In those circumstances, you are allowed to make changes to terms and conditions of employment, okay? The other situation where you can make changes to terms and conditions of employment is if the contractual terms of the transferring employees permit it. So if under their existing contracts of employment, there's a flexibility clause that permits you to make the change you're seeking to make, then you're allowed to make it, because technically, I guess it's not a change to terms and conditions. The existing contract already provides for some flexibility. An example of that could be a mobility clause, for example. So you may need to relocate to be transferring people, but if there's a mobility clause in there which stands up, you can rely on the mobility clause to make the change. So bear that in mind. For those of you that operate in a unionized environment or inherit people that come from unionized environments, you are allowed to make changes to terms that are derived from a collective agreement, so a collectively negotiated agreement with a trade union. But those variations must take effect more than a year after the transfer. So there's kind of a waiting period. I think you can talk to people about it in the meantime, but there's this waiting period in terms of when those changes can take effect. And finally, if you're inheriting employees because there are relevant insolvency proceedings, prior to the transfer, so they're the circumstances in which you're inheriting employees, you're also allowed to make changes to T's and C's. Now, it gets super technical and beyond what you will want to hear about in the next 2 minutes in terms of what relevant insolvency proceedings actually means. There's been a load of litigation on that. But just take it that if there are relative insolvency proceedings, you are permitted to make changes. In all of the circumstances, if you're making changes that are connected with the 2P transfer, they're going to be void changes. And by the way, it doesn't matter if on balance, the package that an individual is getting is overall better for them, those changes will still be voidable if you're trying to make them. If you're trying to make changes connected with the 2P transfer and go through a dismissal and re-engage exercise, those dismissals are likely to be automatically unfair as well. So obviously creates some additional liability there. Otherwise, the starting point is you're not permitted to make the change. Now, as ever with employment law, there are certain workarounds, there are certain strategies that you can deploy. The passage of time doesn't help you really either. It doesn't matter if you're looking to make changes a year or two down the line. If it's still connected with the original 2B transfer, the individual employees will have protection. Where passage of time does help you is in the minds of the employees, it may not be so obvious that there is a link between those two things. So it can be to your benefit in that situation. But otherwise, starting point shouldn't be changing T's and C's. Let me just have a look at some of the questions that we've had in. So material detriment, does this include redundancy measures post-transfer by the transferee? Not if so. If there are redundancy situations post-transfer by the transferee and they fall within the ambit of an economic, technical, or organizational reason, then you're allowed to make those changes. And you could have a situation where it's a post-transfer redundancy by the transferee. And second question from the same person, does this impact change in location, offshoring, 2P matters? Well, it does. I mean, 2P can apply to transfers going offshore, so outside of the UK. Change in location then becomes an issue and it will fall into the bracket of ETO. But to the person who asked those two questions, I know my colleague who's supporting you with the particular matter that underpins those questions is looking at this. So please do carry on that conversation with Adrienne because I know that's a live issue for you. But thanks for the questions. Someone else has asked, can the transferer make an employee redundant if the transferee intends to change their role substantially? Yeah, that's a good question because that scenario comes up quite a lot. There is a mechanism for making pre-transfer redundancies. And the reason it gets a little bit complicated is because if you're going to make redundancies because you're saying to your employees, look, it's better for us to make you redundant than you transfer to this new employer and they make you redundant, we can build some certainty into what the process looks like. Technically, it's not your reason, it's not your redundancy reason. So it's questionable that you can actually make a fair dismissal because you don't have a redundancy situation. It's the transferee's redundancy situation. It's the new employer's redundancy situation. But it's not unknown at all for the parties to come to a commercial agreement where the transferee will say, hey, transferor, as part of this deal, will you agree to do some pre-transfer redundancies and then we'll sweep up any liability within the commercial agreement? So that's achievable. Comes back to this commercial contract, what warranties and indemnities you have in there, how the liabilities are portioned, but you'd factor it into the commercial terms. So the purported income and employer might bung you some more money to cover the costs of you making people redundant pre-transfer. So that happens. And question from Elizabeth. Thanks, Elizabeth. What if terms are more favorable, please? Well, it kind of depends if you're talking about terms that are just straightforwardly more favorable, like the examples I gave, more annual leave and more pay, there's no issue. No one's going to complain about that. You're not going to have a problem. Where employees have got into trouble is where they've tried to argue that overall the package is more favourable, but there are elements of that package that are now more unfavourable. So, an example that jumps to mind is somebody's on a 3-month post-termination restriction. So, their restricted covenants like non-compete clause are there for 3 months. They transfer over to a new employer. The new employer says, well, we want those to be 6 months because that's what all of our other employees have. And we think that better protects our business. So we'll give you a 6-month non-compete clause in your contract, but we'll double your base salary or we'll give you this massive bonus. So, hey, overall, you're up because you're getting paid more money and our benefits are better. But you've got this detrimental thing compared with pre-transfer. Now, the courts have said, well, it doesn't matter about this argument that overall the employees are up, that change is still voidable. And the issue for the new employer there is actually they can't rely on the benefit of a 6-month restriction. And another question, what benefits subject to PG, someone that has PMI, but the current employer does not offer that? Yeah, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the situation regarding PMI, whether you have to offer a comparable provision. Similarly, in terms of pension benefit, it can be hard to replicate those. I think you have to try and do your best in terms of replication, but I confess it's been a while since I've looked at PMI specifically, and off the top of my head, I don't know what the exact position is. So apologies for that. That takes us very slightly over time. So as always, thanks for joining us today. As a reminder, we've got something like nearly 60 episodes on Spotify and Amazon Music. So there's subjects for everybody on there. So please go and check out our recordings. Video recording of this will be on our website next week. If I can ask a favor, if you know anyone that would be interested in either attending these sessions or listening to our sessions, please do spread the word as we try and grow our audience. But as always, Thanks for joining. Thanks for the questions. I'm going to be back in 2 weeks' time, hopefully with Adrienne. We'll be here at 11 and look out for the invite for that. But enjoy the rest of your week in the meantime. Thanks very much.